We're back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Daniela Guzman Peña, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is the Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy.
Hi, Joan.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's great to have you.
Always a pleasure to do anything with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry.
Great. Well, welcome everyone to the Tech Policy Grind, where we explore the biggest stories that are shaping technology, policy, and society. Today, we're going to be diving into one of the most significant antitrust cases in modern tech history, the U.S. Department of Justice's battle with Google. Earlier this week, today is actually November 22nd, so we're recording 2 days after the DOJ proposed a groundbreaking remedy, which was to force Google to sell off its Chrome browser. This proposal follows a landmark ruling back in August of 2024 when Judge Amit P. Mehta of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia found that Google had illegally maintained a monopoly in online search and asked the Department of Justice and the states that brought the case to submit solutions by the end of Wednesday this week to correct the search monopoly. So what's at stake here? We're looking at the future of competition in search and online advertising with potential ripple effects across the tech industry. And among the proposed remedies, the government asked Google to make a critical choice, either to sell Android, its smartphone operating system, or to stop making its services mandatory on Android phones. If these remedies fail to improve competition, the government could force Google to sell Android at a later date. So, to help us unpack what all of this means, I'm thrilled to welcome Joe Jerome to the show. Joe is a policy expert at DuckDuckGo, a company that's long advocated for fair competition in search and privacy-first alternatives. And with his deep insights into tech policy and antitrust, Joe is here to help us understand exactly what is at stake and what the future might look like if regulators succeed in breaking up Google's grip on the market. So without further ado, Joe, welcome to the Tech Policy Grind.
Thank you. That was an incredibly kind introduction. I wouldn't say I have any great expertise. Actually, as I have dived into this work at DuckDuckGo, I mean, obviously as a competitor to Google and a privacy-focused search engine, we have a particular axe to grind, if I can talk about grinding some more on this podcast. But the intersection and overlap between privacy and competition and a healthier online ecosystem is really complicated. We've had conversations before about this case at different stages. And now that we actually have this 35-page proposal by the Department of Justice, there's a ton of stuff to unpack I won't claim any grand expertise in. Though, considering I've actually read the proposal, maybe I have more expertise than most folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're more of an expert than most of us. So why don't we start off with a big picture view and assume that folks have never heard about this case before. So the DOJ's case against Google and the proposed remedies are, as you said, they're pretty unprecedented. That's why we're talking about them today.
Yeah, look, right? I think this is a huge case. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm biased, but I've been routinely sort of shocked at how little coverage this has received. This is right up there, and the Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor, when the decision was first announced in August. He said that this was up there on the Mount Rushmore of antitrust decisions. And I see this as part of a chain of cases that have really completely reshaped the not just the internet, but the technology ecosystem. So, you know, before Google, 20 years ago, the Department of Justice had sort of a groundbreaking case against Microsoft that led to not just like antitrust remedies, but it really, I think everybody would say, allowed the breathing space for today's companies like Google to come to the surface. You go back another 20 years and you have, of course, the longstanding breakup of AT&T by the federal government, which is, you know, a telecommunications issue, but at its core was really about technology. AT&T wanted to get rid of the baby bells so that Bell Labs and, you know, Western Electric were the innovative technologies that were, in the words of the AT&T CEO at the time, gonna bring AT&T into the age of computers. Didn't really shake out that way, but, you know, AT&T is still a clear big player. But these cases and these antitrust actions have historically been really important tools for unlocking innovation. And so now Google is, I think, rightly in the crosshairs. You know, so we have obviously this case that has held that Google is a monopolist under, you know, Section 2 of the Sherman Act. But there are other cases against Google and its anti-competitive activities. There's, a case involving Google's ad tech business. There have been private lawsuits from Epic about how Google runs the Play Store. And, you know, in the background of this, there are other, you know, global regulators and regulations like the EU Digital Markets Act, which are really trying to change how Google and the search business has functioned. And, you know, I always look at a lot of the people who say, and I think there was, when the decision first came down, this idea like who cares, even if Google is a bad actor, like there's a sort of sense of inevitability about some of this. But I think that this case is really the manifestation of widespread bipartisan. I think it's always worth highlighting that, you know, this case against Google was brought by the first Trump administration and pursued to success by the Biden administration, along with, as you mentioned, a bipartisan coalition of AGs. There's deep-seated interest in sort of shaking things up a bit and dislodging Google from its dominant position in search. And I think that has that doesn't just have ramifications for a competing search engine like DuckDuckGo. I think it has ramifications for how all of us experience search online and actually rather, I mean, get access to information.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought up those two cases of Microsoft and AT&T, because those are sort of the historic parallels to this case against Google. You know, really large companies that are sort of, you know, at the forefront of emerging technology at the time, and they are also sort of seen as a monopoly that needs to be broken up. What lessons can we learn from those past antitrust cases, and how is Google different from those cases?
Great question. So I actually think, so you mentioned that the big headlines have been about how the Department of Justice has basically called for Google to spin off Chrome, and depending on some things, potentially also Android. Those are all the headlines. Government calls for breakup of Google. Those are, you know, in antitrust law, those are what's known as structural remedies. That is the lesson. I think that is the lesson you can take away from the AT&T case. We're going to take this giant dominant company and slice it into pieces and hopefully unlock innovation that way. And that tends to be, I mean, the appeal of structural remedies is that they are generally permanent. Although in the case of AT&T, we did see how a lot of the companies sort of formed and came back together over time. You know, both today's current AT&T and Verizon were both like part of the original AT&T breakup. But, you know, structural remedies tend to be, I think the description is like they are clean. They're like a scalpel. And so they make sort of permanent changes to the market. The Microsoft case, although it initially involved discussions of breaking up Microsoft, ultimately became a case about behavioral remedies. So that's, if you're not going to do structural remedies, you can change the behavior of big companies, big tech companies. And so I think there are tons and tons of lessons from the Microsoft case in terms of both like what went well, what went wrong. Some of the things that come out of that case that I think are worth mentioning are that, and I think everybody describes this as like the success story of the Microsoft case, was the creation of what was known as a technical committee. In the past, when you would have breakups of companies, you'd have these sort of legalistic, like a special advisor to sort of manage things. Well, you know, courts, with all due respect, are not necessarily experts at understanding technology. And when you are trying to change the behavior of a big tech monopolist like Google, that's not something that lawyers alone are going to be equipped to do. And so, you know, in the Microsoft case, they created a technical committee of experts. One expert was appointed by the Department of Justice. One expert was appointed by Microsoft. And those two experts then appointed a third expert. So it was like a triumvirate. You have a similar structure has been proposed by the Department of Justice here, which is calling for people that have, again, to highlight that this isn't necessarily about the law. This is about experts with people of expertise in software engineering, information retrieval, artificial intelligence. There's the first mention of AI in the podcast today, economics and behavioral science. So you need people with that sort of expertise to be able to handle these sorts of things. And I think that is the lesson of the Microsoft case and something we should bring forward to the Google case. I am jumping all over you. I talked a bunch of stuff and didn't answer your other question about what's unique about Google. All right.
I was just going to say that you're bringing up the triumvirate, and I wonder how, you know, in this case for Google, how important do you think like an expert committee is going to be in sort of bringing that technical expertise on how do we actually, you know, put in place these remedies, whether they're structural or behavioral?
So, and I will get this for you for the show notes. There's articles that have highlighted how you sort of have to keep companies accountable in these instances. I think there's claims often of if you don't have people with wide ranging expertise and it's just a couple of lawyers saying do certain things, companies have incentives to engage in, you know, what is derisively known as malicious compliance. Though I would argue that's maybe not accurate. They are taking a conservative legal approach to their obligations, and they do so in a way that ensures that those obligations don't help anybody. DuckDuckGo actually has a great example of that. We this week actually published a blog on our Spread Privacy website, basically calling for the European Commission to enter into a couple of non-compliance investigations into how Google is approaching the DMA. And I can give you some examples of where things have, you know, why you need wide-ranging expertise. So one obligation in the DMA is that gatekeepers like Google show choice screens to all new users. And Google has done this to some effect on Pixel devices, but even though they have incredible dominance over the Android ecosystem, they've disclaimed the ability to sort of push that choice screen out to existing users. So if you've had a Samsung phone from 2 years ago, you're not getting that choice screen. So that's a way that I think Google has interpreted the law in a way that really undermines the impact of choice screens. If you're not bullish or care about choice screens, something that is actually also more relevant to the case, the Google search case, is the Digital Markets Act requires that Google share what's known as click, query, and ranking data with search engine competitors. Google has, to basically meet this obligation, Google has launched what's known as the Google European Search Dataset Licensing Program, very sexy title, which gives, which allows a company like DuckDuckGo to pay money to get some of this click and query data. According to our own analysis, the data in there eliminates 99% of search queries. If you are a privacy advocate, you're probably going to say that that's great. But the end result here is that Google is complying with a legal obligation in such a way as to make it utterly and essentially useless. And our argument has been that they are using privacy as an excuse to avoid complying with the law. Get into that. There's a lot of more nuance there. But again, that highlights why you need wide-ranging expertise to monitor these companies, because that is the lesson that we haven't really seen in Europe under the DMA. It's a little bit more hands-off by the European Commission. When you see what the DOJ is proposing with respect to Google over here, it's a much more robust proposal.
And let's get into a little bit more detail on this request to sell off Chrome. So the rationale behind this proposal is that because Chrome is integrated with Google's search engine and Chrome is the most widely used web browser, it serves as like a gateway for most internet users, and that is kind of a reinforcement of Google's market dominance and doesn't really allow for competition. How do you think that this sell-off would change the landscape of the internet and the way that consumers actually interact with the internet?
So I think it's a really interesting question, and it raises, I think, actually tough questions about the role of online services and then sort of more technical infrastructure like the browser. There are people, let's acknowledge that there are people that like how integrated Chrome is with different sorts of Google services, but that creates some really negative incentives for Google to play nice with others. We've seen this in the instance of, I found this sort of amusing. If any of you have used Perplexity AI, they're sort of a GPT-based search engine. Well, they're not a search engine. They are an AI search service, and they offered a plugin to become the default, like how you get answers if you're using Chrome. Instead of getting a Google search, you would get like the AI answer from Perplexity, and their CEO was out there tweeting talking about how, hey, when people download and install this plugin saying that they want to use us, Google puts up a whole lot of banners, some might call them dark patterns, to sort of say don't use this, switch back to Google. I think that's where the call to spin off Chrome is coming from. The fact that even though Google will repeatedly say that Chrome and search are not the same product, that's just, I think that doesn't pass the smell test. I mean, we've seen leaks and reporting about how signals from the Chrome browser get incorporated into, search metrics within Google. So it is a service that is intertwined with search. Now, I think I'm going to keep pushing back on you on this because, again, I know that everybody gets really excited about this idea of breaking up and splintering off parts of Google.
It's a headline.
It is a headline.
It's very big. And people recognize what this means. They're like using Google Chrome every day. So it's something that affects their daily life. Whereas if you talk about data sharing agreements or default agreements,
I would argue that innovative and changes to different, like having different search competitors, will also change how people browse the internet. But I do take your point. I think an independent Google in some respects could be really interesting in terms of, again, Google has done things where it's preferenced the ability to post and share and incorporate YouTube videos. You have a real issue where, the podcast service that we're using to record this right now only works in Chrome. So you have a lot of services that increasingly are designed exclusively for Chrome. And that, again, further, when you tie in all the other stuff we're seeing with respect to, you know, the ad tech case, which goes over my head and I'm not qualified to speak about, but it all is like a web of connections that just make everybody very dependent on Google and gives them money and dominance in a way that just crushes competition. So I'm gonna force this in because I think I'm obliged to say that, like, the structural provisions in this DOJ filing, I mean, they don't make up the majority of the filing. There are sections that are very exciting for a company like DuckDuckGo that require Google to make available its search index. There's a section that would require Google to offer sort of temporary licensing of its results, which scale back over time. And I'm going to keep bringing up these provisions because I think they directly address what the court found initially, which is Google's exclusive defaults. The fact that 70% of all of the access points that you use to access the internet are largely controlled by Google search. That distribution advantage gives them a huge scale advantage. And the line that I always take away from the case is the fact that the amount of information, and this isn't just personal data or use, like the amount of queries, the amount of information that Google search gathers in 13.5 months is the equivalent of it would take Bing 17 years to see that much data. So there is a huge disparity in data. It creates a sort of this flywheel effect where every place you access the internet is controlled by Google, which means Google gets more data, which means Google gets more advertisers, which means Google gets more money to just keep like locking people into the system. And you know, there's this assumption that Google search is great. It's a great product, and that's why people use it. And look, I should be here to evangelize why people should use alternatives like DuckDuckGo or Ecosia or anybody. You know, the reality is there are studies that have shown that, and the court case found that Google is able to use Cory Doctorow's term, inshittify their own search results. And that has nothing to do with the underlying index or technology. It's literally Google putting its thumb on the scale to throw up more ads, to throw up more SEO, that search engine optimized AI slop, that makes it harder for people to actually find things. And I think that has had a deleterious effect, not just on search, but our information ecosystem. And you know, if you're really, if you really care about tech policy, I think it has hurt the open web. And we need to figure out ways to let people access information in better, unique, more innovative ways.
I'm with you. I think we need to talk about all of these remedies and to really, you know, get past what is, I think, the most sort of appealing or shocking headline, which is the divestiture of Chrome. but I do think the data sharing remedy is really important, and the end to these exclusive deals that would make Google sort of the default service on devices. I think that that's really important. There's also this this remedy on limiting Google's use of its search data to train artificial intelligence models, which could help further, you know, prevent further entrenchment in its market position. So curious about that piece. I know we said we wouldn't make this totally about AI, but because this remedy is addressing another type of monopolistic behavior that is now, you know, super, I think, in the spotlight because of the emergence of all of these, you know, AGI services, what are the potential consequences for AI development and competition in this space, if this becomes something that's enforceable?
The AI of it all is unavoidable. I do feel like I should note that, you know, we're seeing challenges right now because the historical, I guess the bargain that existed was you had crawlers like Google. They were out there crawling the internet. And there, you know, there are costs to websites for this. Crawling and making a map of the internet that then, you know, because we let people do that, or publishers, websites let people do that, it makes it so it's easier to find them. And those same crawlers are now being used not just to index and make that those websites available, they are being used to get the information from those websites and put it into the AI machine, ghost in the machine. You know, I think it's worth highlighting that, you know, DuckDuckGo has been exploring how to use LLM and AI assisted search. You know, we're very proud of the fact that, you know, we allow people to opt out of that. You know, we're seeing some interesting conversations right now about, you know, the way web crawling has historically been governed has been self-regulation might not be the right word, but almost, I guess, a gentleman's handshake and agreement to follow what's known as the robots.txt file. Basically, websites can have a text file that tells robots what these robots can grab. And, you know, we're sort of seeing that break down in the age of AI. And so, you know, that's an underlying issue of, I mean, I think that highlights, to make my point here, it highlights how the AI of it all is sort of getting smashed in with search. And we see this, as you point out in your question, it's manifest in this, in what the Department of Justice was concerned about. If you followed this case, a lot of the arguments before the judge about what discovery would look like and what they were arguing about in terms of remedies involved, like, what do we mean by AI? You know, when Google talks about AI, is it just Gemini, or is it some other, you know, deep mind type stuff out there that, you know, they will incorporate into their products? Is it partnerships with, you know, the Anthropics of the world, on and on and on. So I think that this proposal that Google allow creators to opt out of things, it's a good proposal. I think it's good. I think it's what a lot of creators want to see. They want to have more control over their stuff. Now, obviously, that's a separate conversation about intellectual property rights and other sorts of things. But you know, not for you go back. You were asking me like why we need all these experts to keep Google accountable. I mean, they're not for nothing. You know, we've seen Google inject Gemini into its search, and as a result, tell people to go put glue on pizza and eat rocks. But it's likely that you're going to see more of that. Those types of assistance. I've already mentioned Perplexity, ChatGPT, or OpenAI is rolling out a similar sort of functionality. You're going to see this blurring of AI assistance and traditional search. How that shakes out, I don't think we know yet. I think they provide very different types of service. I mean, you know, search engines are primarily, and this is, you know, this tickles the lawyer part of my brain. You know, I read a lot of bills, and a lot of bills are supposed to cover tech and platforms, and particularly social media. There's never, I'm always looking for definitions of what is search. I don't know if we have a lot of legal definitions of what is search,
but
I think the way DuckDuckGo thinks about search is you put in a query, and historically it has been, you get links back, but you also get other sorts of information modules. And so basically we think of search as queries that go ping this index of the internet and present a whole bunch of information back. AI chatbots, on the other hand, can have some of that similar functionality, but are designed to bring back specific information and to directly answer your question and to be more conversational. And so that is very different from the like search and retrieve model that we have historically seen in search. Now, again, I think that may all be evolving here. And I think the Department of Justice's concern is that Google, you know, seeing the youth of America flock to TikTok as their new form of search, and then seeing all of the excitement around generative AI, like, they want to leverage their existing dominance and control over the search market to control all of this AI stuff. And that also is an unfair competitive practice. It's fruits of the poisonous tree, so to speak. Google created this unlawful search monopoly, and now they get to leverage it to do AI things. That's like, from my perspective, doubly unfair. But you know, we'll see how all of that goes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to think about what Google might be thinking in terms of where it exercises its market power in this AI race. And I think the AI, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I just to interrupt, to talk over you, I think one other point that's worth acknowledging here is, and again, I would point everyone in the DOJ to read the DOJ filing, or at least their cover letter, or specifically Section 6, which talks about making Google's search index available. You know, I think some people would suggest that this is almost like basically turning Google's map of the internet into a utility of sorts. And to sort of preempt your question, we've already seen Google offering basically the ability to use Gemini or Google search index as a way to ground LLMs. One of the issues with LLMs is, you know, they're not so great so far at like breaking news, current information. And that is the benefit of having Google's massive index of the internet. It knows what is most recent, and it knows how to, you know, update AI in real time in a way that hopefully, I mean, you know, dealing with LLM-based hallucinations is another issue entirely. But feeding it more relevant and fresh information on the back of its search index is one way, again, Google's trying to leverage its search dominance in AI. And there have been some announcements about that publicly.
Yeah, and I think just to kind of take the perspective of Google here for a second and to, you know, put ourselves in their shoes. I know that's not something you want to do, but I know, you know, Google has criticized these remedies or these proposals as overly broad and potentially harmful to consumers. I mean, they clearly don't want this to affect their business. And they indicate plans to appeal any of these adverse rulings. And the legal proceedings are ongoing. There's still, you know, court hearings scheduled for April of next year, with a final decision expected by August 2025. There's also a new administration in the U.S., which could change the stance on antitrust enforcement, or even just like influence the case's trajectory. So from Google's point of view, are they worried that this sort of you must sell is going to go through? Like, what do you think they're thinking at this point?
Wow, that's a phenomenal question. And I don't know if I could put myself in the shoes of Kent Walker. I mean, I think you highlight the reality that this is a long, ongoing process. You know, even after a decision next fall or next August, appeals will take more years. And so, you know, I think Google has given every indication that they are ready to fight this for the long haul. It's not clear to me what they would actually settle for. I think they've set the table a little bit to talk about, you know, what they have had to do under the DMA in the EU, which is choice screens, not demanding that Android become, you know, include all of Google search, but if it's preloaded, okay. And then, you know, I already mentioned their sort of really craptacular click and query data set licensing program. You know, I could see if the agreement was Google just had to do that in the US, they'd probably acquiesce pretty quickly. I think the Department of Justice has realized that, like, that you know, having won a decision that has found Google to be an illegal monopolist, that sort of settlement is useless. My inclination is that Google will fight these things tooth or nail. I think that they have. I mean, it's unclear to me. Well, I just sort of said what I think they'd accept, but I think it's worth highlighting to listeners that Google has, so the Department of Justice has filed its draft order. And then in December 20th, before Christmas, Google has to file its draft order. And if you've ever practiced like legal practice, I mean, these draft orders are, you know, you give these to the judge and you hope the judge sort of embraces your language. I cannot wait to read what Google puts out on December 20th because their position has been that they've done nothing wrong, even in the face of the fact that they've done many things wrong. And that even if they have done something wrong, this is going to be, you know, their list of issues that they're, it's bad for users, it's bad for privacy, it's bad for small businesses, it's bad for the tech companies, it's bad for the AI Cold War race, it's bad for national, like, it's just a laundry list of things that are bad, which I don't mean to be so flippant as to dismiss all of them, but these are the same exact arguments that like AT&T trotted out 40 years ago. I was reading a book, Deal of the Century, same arguments. So any company that's being faced with like legal liability is going to, you know, play the woe is me card. And I think we should look at all of these arguments with a grain of salt. You know, I understand that some people view Google as a benevolent actor in the online ecosystem. But again, I'll come back to how I started that, you know, this isn't really just about Google. This is about concerns about the dominance of big tech generally. A lot of the interest in this case starts from, work that had been done by Congressman Cicilline in Congress to look at like the issues within big tech. That's all my way of saying, like, I think that there's plenty of appetite to continue to hold Google's feet to the fire. You mentioned the change of administration. It's clear, you know, the president-elect has, you know, made some things about, actually, you know, to the extent everyone's talking about the breakup of Google, he has pointedly said he's not exactly necessarily interested in breaking up Google. He obviously is, you know, interested in cutting deals. But I think he has been given a great set of facts and a bunch of hard work by the DOJ to, as he might put it, get a good deal out of Google that could actually be good for internet users generally.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out once the new administration is in office, but also how this case in the U.S. might influence the global regulatory landscape. You talked a little bit about the DMA, but how do you think this might influence international antitrust policies?
My background is as a privacy lawyer, hence why I was interested in joining DuckDuckGo. And so my experience is largely that, like, you know, privacy regulators were always talking around the globe. And I think that the same is true for competition regulators. They're watching what each other are doing. They're following stuff. They're learning from each other. Again, you're seeing this tightening web of activity targeted toward Google happening everywhere. There are competition efforts in Japan, the United Kingdom. The Competition Markets Authority is investigating search and is likely to do some interesting things around search as well that will be unique and distinct from what the EU is doing. I'm sure I could go through a laundry list of other countries that are looking at this stuff. It's all to say that, like, I think Google has, you know, it has had 15 to 20 years of smooth sailing, and I guess I'd say the chickens have sort of come home to roost a little bit, and they're facing a really tough global regulatory environment. And I don't think any of that's going away.
Do you think other regulators are sort of waiting until August 2025 to see how this all shakes out so they can maybe kind of ride on the coattails of that?
So I'm not far be for me to assume how they think about things, but I think a lot of these countries are on different time frames. So like the Digital Markets Act, for example, went into effect earlier in 2024. Mm-hmm. The European Commission is in line to sort of review and assess how the DMA is functioning and how it's going, I believe in 2026. So once that comes around, they will have all of this stuff to look at. And, you know, where and how different remedies that have been proposed have been effective, where Google has tried to circumvent them. You know, fortunately, they'll be, you know, certainly DuckDuckGo will still be around trying to make our case. So I think there's going to be lots of different bites of the apple here.
Great. Well, Joe, this has been really enlightening. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us. And this has been a really interesting conversation. I think we should chat again, maybe after the December draft or the April court proceeding. I think we should maybe do a follow-up to that.
We should do a compare contrast. Yeah. There's something like 12 or 13 sections in the DOJ's filing. Let's see if Google can, you know, put more than one page together.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks so much, Joe. We really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks. Happy holidays, everybody.
Happy holidays.
The Tech Policy Grind podcast was created by fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. It's co-produced by myself, Daniela Guzman-Pena, and Evan Enzer, the editor and co-executive producer. Special thanks to Jess, Fiducci, and Eric for their collaboration and support in bringing this episode to air. I and the other Foundry fellows engage with the Foundry voluntarily and in our personal capacities. The views and opinions expressed on air do not reflect on the organizations we are affiliated with. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind podcast. Be sure to check out the Foundry on LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps out the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, reach out to us at foundrypodcasts@ilpfoundry.us. You can find our email in the show notes as well. See you next time.